Live from F102, this is Art As We Know It. This is our 12th episode of our bi-monthly podcast. With this podcast, we hope to share art knowledge and help inspire others to find art in their daily lives. I'm Patrick, and today on this episode, we have Kendall, Haley, Alana, and Piper. Today, we'll start off with the trivia question of the day with Alana.
So, last week we asked you, who directed the famous 1902 movie, A Trip to the Moon? And the answer was Georges Méliès, which is actually, if y'all have seen the movie Hugo from, I think, 2012, that's what Hugo's about. It's about his movies and stuff like that.
Today in art history, on May 1st in 1954, Ray Parker was born. Ray Parker was an American singer, songwriter, guitarist, producer, and worked on the classic Ghostbuster movie theme. Our topic today is about art as film, and our first topic is going to start with Piper in independent and artsy films.
All right, what's up, guys? So today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics of all time, which is films, right? And I kind of wanted to start off and talk about independent and artsy films, which I think are two different categories, because you have your independent films or indie films, which are typically movies that have an extremely low budget. There's no like set number for it, but I think generally it's like under like $2 million, which you would think that's a lot of money. It's you would think that's a lot of money to make a movie, but it like goes by really quickly when you consider all of the actors and the crew and everyone involved in the movie making process. Right? So indie films that we know about as like a culture are ones that have gone on to create like successful franchises. Like, for example, you can talk about like Paranormal Activity or Saw. Like, both of these movies are horror movies that created, like, had this bright idea, like, from students right out of grad school, and they were like, I want to make a movie, don't have any money, here, let's do something in one room. And they're both like pretty good movies, and that sparked a franchise that obviously became very popular. I also kind of want to note, like, Blair Witch Project, which is, like, a whole cult movie, and that created, like, this whole, like internet, like, fascination with people, because they legitimately thought the movie was real, even though, like, as an audience now, like, watching it 20 years later, we can tell, like, oh, yeah, no, this is fake. But the whole concept was that, oh, yeah, these are the actors, but their names are legitimately what they are in the movie, so no one could tell whether or not, like, this movie was actually found footage or was something else, right?
Yeah, another really good indie film or like low budget film was Napoleon Dynamite. That has a really big cult following. They actually spent $400,000 on it. They end up making $46.1 million, which is a pretty good ratio of spent to made. So yeah, that's just one thing I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, it goes to show that you don't have to have all the money in the world to execute a good film.
Yeah, that film's really popular, so I feel like a lot of independent films, you know, get a lot of recognition, even though they don't spend as much money as some of the longer feature films.
Definitely. And even have, like, movies like The Room, which the disaster artist, like, took in, like, focused on, which The Room, it's so bad. not the one with Brie Larson. No, the one with Brie Larson is great. Like, I love that movie. But the one, like, from, like, what is it, like, the late 90s, it's so bad, and yet so many people love the movie so much.
It's so bad, it's good.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, you know, how some people are like, oh, that dog's so ugly, it's cute.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that for movies.
Exactly.
All dogs are cute.
Yeah, all dogs are cute. Yeah, actually, the most expensive film ever made was Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. It estimated around $400 million to film it, and wow, it made, I have no idea. They all kind of mold together.
I don't even think, like, it made that much in return, though. Yeah. Like, it probably made a lot, but
not, like,
$400 million. Yeah. All right, so we have, like, those independent films, right? But we also have, like, these artsy films, and I think that artsy films are typically whenever a director is more well-established and they have the room to do what they please, right? And they have the room to, like, create something that, you know, coincides with their visual aesthetic. So, for example, you have, like, Wes Anderson, who's kind of known as being the king of artsy films. You know, even his first films have a certain look to them, and each shot is set up. And he really focuses on symmetry and color values, you know? Each movie has, like, a certain set of colors that he uses throughout. And it's really interesting to go through and watch a Wes Anderson film with a critical eye, because they all have, like, this common theme of, like, family, I guess, in a way. It's just Yeah. Wes Anderson, like, also has, like, a cult following. People love Wes Anderson. I like him, too, but, you know, I'm not necessarily someone to, like, go out and say, like, yes, I love Wes Anderson. Like, I'm a Wes Anderson fan, you know? But you also have artists like Quentin Tarantino, who's known for his very pointed style, you know, that he's developed throughout multiple years. And you also have, like, Spike Lee, who, with Black Klansman, has become even more into the limelight. And he has such interesting, like, shots, especially the one where he has the actors on a dolly and he's moving them forward. So they're not actually walking, but it just looks like they're coming through space. Like, that's his classic, you know, Spike Lee shot that he has in, like, all of his movies. And, like, one of my personal favorite directors is Alfonso Cuarón with Roma. It's such a beautifully shot film. It's so quiet, especially with the black and white. It gives you such a nice, like, artsy, you know, feel to it. And so I honestly love his work.
When I think about artsy films and artsy directors, I think about Tim Burton because his vision is just so unique and dark and playful, and he really brings a sense of his creativity to every film he does. And what I really find interesting about him is that he originally worked for Disney, like, straight out of school, and his first project he started working on with Disney was the film where the boy brings his dog back to life.
Oh, it's Frankenweenie,
yeah. And they actually fired him because it was too dark. But now, just this year, they've rehired him to direct Dumbo for them. So I think it's interesting that his talent and his vision preceded that, and he didn't let it, you know, bring him down in the business. And now the company had invited him back this year to do something with their property.
Didn't he at some point work with Laika Productions, Claymation?
Well, I think Laika kind of, like, takes a lot of inspiration from Tim Burton. Because, like, you watch, like, Coraline, and a lot of people are, like, surprised to hear that's not a Tim Burton film. Well, because it has, like, the same feel, and the stop animation definitely gives it, like, a certain, you know, feeling.
I know Laika is technically, the company that has rights, or not necessarily rights, too, but they claimed Corpse Bride. So I guess, like, Tim Burton worked with them for that one.
All right, yeah.
I really like how he puts, like, a dark turn on most of his movies, because even if it's a children's movie, it still has a kind of a dark feel to it, which is really unique, and I kind of like that. I kind of enjoy it. I think it's funny, but also it's interesting.
Definitely.
Yeah, it keeps it entertaining, you know, because there'll be laughable parts, but there'll also be really eerie parts where you kind of get creeped out.
It's also really interesting to, like, go back and watch Tim Burton movies that you saw as a child. Because I remember watching, like, Nightmare Before Christmas, and I was completely freaked out. I was like, this is weird. I don't like this, you know. And going back and watching it, like, you start to understand, like, some of the jokes, and you have a greater appreciation for it. So, over time, it's like, I think people like Tim Burton more, like, as they grow older. Because, like, some of his movies definitely are pointed towards a younger audience. But, like, as someone who's older watching it, you start to understand, like, the subtleties in his work. And it just quite, you know, how extravagant his creativity is.
The person who directed Coraline actually worked on their first, like, working on a big production with Tim Burton for The Nightmare Before Christmas, which is why kind of they look similar in style. So I think, like, he worked as some sort of, that word, apprentice? Not necessarily apprentice, but, like,
yeah, he took inspiration from it, definitely.
Currently, one of the directors that I've been watching, well, he's actually only has one feature film, but his name is Blitz the Ambassador. He is a Ghanaian. What do you say, Ghanaian?
He's from Ghana.
He's Ghanaian American. He did, like music first, but he ventured into film. And he has this movie on Netflix, The Burial of Kojo. And what I really liked about that was the way they told the story was like hearing a fable. Like, you know how whenever you're little, you'd go to the library and they'd read fables to you. It sounds like you're being read to a fable, but also plays a lot with camera angles. He has, like, some things that are upside down, like, literally upside down. I was, like, turning around my phone. I was like, wait, is it this way? And I was like, oh, wait, no, that's what he wanted to do. And then I just kind of like the way it looked.
A director that I've been following in his freshman career is Key and Peele. And,
Wait, you mean Jordan Peele?
Jordan Peele.
Jordan Peele, yeah.
Key and Peele, yeah.
Who originally worked on Key and Peele.
There you go.
On Comedy Central. And I remember watching that years ago. To see him, like, branch off into the directing world is really awesome, because he's created a really unique style with Get Out and Us recently. And now he's directing the new Twilight Zone Twilight Zone installation. And it's like a perfect show for him to do because it just matches his style really well. He's also very eerie. He mixes like a lot of comedy and horror. He is very meticulous with his directing. He doesn't waste a single shot. A lot of symbolism and a lot of foreshadowing in every film he does. So that's why I really appreciate his work.
I think it's so interesting how Jordan Peele was able to rebrand himself. Like, originally known as this funny guy, you know, Key and Peele has his own comedy show, and all of a sudden he's seen as, like, one of the leading horror directors, and, you know, especially with Get Out and the critical acclaim it received, it's just amazing to watch his career progress and still continue to progress. Because he's, like, a middle-aged man that's just now starting his directing career, but it's still, like, so interesting to see where he's going to go from here.
It makes me want to, like, go back and watch Key and Peele. Like, was there, like, signs that he was into this sort of stuff? Like, where, like, I have no idea where this is coming from, but I'm happy it's happening because I love his movies.
Yeah, he's really creative, and you could see that, like, how he writes for Comedy Central. But I would have to look at his other stuff because I'm sure he has earlier stuff than Comedy Central. Any other directors you guys want to talk about?
Talk about our good old bros, the Russo brothers.
Yes, I'm a fan of them because they can do ensemble casts really well. They've worked on Arrested Development and now on Marvel movies. And they can just take characters and really use their time well within the movie to finish their story arcs of every individual character. It's very characterized in that perspective. And it really gets you, invested in the characters.
I think with the Russo brothers, it's definitely a hit or miss because, sorry, the TikTok song just came in my head, but like, it's, you know, you have a movie like The Winter Soldier, right? Which was, you know, you're introducing, you know, these new characters, this new lore, and yet it's done in such a carefully crafted way so that the whole feel is a spy movie, and it's done really well, I think. And then in contrast, you have, you know, Captain America Civil War, which in my personal opinion just felt really clunky, and that's the best way I can describe it, because it's like, is it a Captain America movie, is it Avengers movie? It's like this awkward love child of the two that still doesn't include like Hulk and Thor, but like whatever. And I just think that, you know, especially with like Infinity War and now Endgame, they have like this huge fan base of people that are really dependent on, not dependent, but like are really looking forward to these movies and this franchise that have been built over the last 10 years. So they have a really heavy hand in how they are shaping these characters that everyone knows and loves. So with Infinity War, a lot of people loved it, a lot of people hated it, and I'm really curious to see how Endgame turns out, because it's going to be 3 hours long, it's going to be an intense emotional movie, you know. And for, I'm pretty sure that, like, Captain America is going to die, but, like, that's just my personal, like, prediction.
I think that no one's going to die, everyone's going to come back to life, and they're all going to be happy.
Okay.
No, I was serious, actually.
Oh.
I personally really like Civil War. I can call it Avengers 2.5. I don't care. It's fine. That's fine with me. But, yeah, I'm really excited to see what they do with this, and what they did with Winter Soldier, which was interesting, is that they kind of reinvented the character of Captain America, because they grew up as fans, and they actually didn't like Captain America. It was one of the heroes that they just
That's why they're going to kill him off.
Exactly!
I guess so. As far as reinventing him, they thought he was square. They thought it was pretty square reading the comics. So they wanted to reinvent him in a way that, you know, took to the modern world, and they definitely took bunch of spy inspiration and went for this like political drama direction with it, which I think really worked out for the MCU.
Let me also say though, I don't like Ultron, so therefore like Ultron's just really bad. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Ultron like, is that the issues, red dude?
Yeah.
No, that's Vision.
Ultron, I like the red dude.
like the movie Age of Ultron, I don't like the movie. That's okay, because it's really forgettable, and you like nothing in that movie is relevant except for the fact that you're introduced to like Wanda and Vision. Yeah. Past that, but you get like the gist of that in Civil War. So like, just like in your rewatch, just like skip over Ultron. It's not necessary. Yeah.
Have y'all ever heard of the director Jennifer Kent?
I don't believe so.
Have y'all ever heard of the movie The Babadook?
I have.
She directed The Babadook.
The Babadook is not scary. Let me just say that first.
It's good though. I really liked it. It did freak me out though.
just like kind of the visuals and the dreary imagery, like all the colors were really washed out. And it felt like, you felt like the walls were closing in whenever you're watching it. And it's just kind of like, ooh, you know what I mean?
I will say, though, I do appreciate the Babadook as an LGBT icon. I prefer that over... Yeah, have you heard about this?
No.
So, here's the thing. What? So, Netflix messed up whenever they were, like, categorizing. And they put, under LGBT movies, they put the Babadook. So, at, like, Pride last year, they had people dressed up as the Babadook. And they had all of this stuff about how the Babadook... The Babadook is now like an LGBT icon, that's, you know? Amazing. So I think that's hilarious, you know, to take this like such dark, grim, like horror movie and turn it into like someone like I saw people like wearing like Babadook costumes, but they had like, you know, heels on and like made it like all cool and stuff. So I think it's hilarious.
You know who else is an LGBTQ icon?
Who?
Li Shang from Mulan, who they decided to cut out of the upcoming movie.
Mm.
Is there any information about the upcoming movie?
It's not a musical. I know that. I'm mad
that's
about
so
that.
Sad.
And is this a Disney film?
Yes.
Well, mm-hmm. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. I feel like there are a lot of really good musical films out there. What are some of y'all's favorites?
I like La La Land.
I do like La La Land.
Okay.
Especially the ending is so different than what you hear, feel like a normal musical movie.
At first, I was, like, really disappointed. I was like, why would they do this? But then I was like, you know what? I'm actually kind of glad it ended that way.
I mean, they each got to achieve their dreams. It's just without each other.
Yeah. It
shows you how expendable some things are. Oh, wait, no. Your loved
one?
Well, I mean, she wasn't in love with him. They just kind of, like...
infatuated.
They weren't, yeah, I'd say infatuated. Please cut this out, Anissa. I don't want people to think I'm, like, a... like, complete...
And it's so what?
I actually really did like the score sound of the La La Land. I like the scene where they're in the planetarium and it starts like first starts off like a little flute and then it moves to the whole entire symphony. I thought that was really good.
Remember when they called out La La Land and then they were like, "Oh, psych, it's Moonlight."
Moonlight was actually pretty good, though.
Moonlight was pretty good. When I first watched it, I didn't really like it just because it is so slow and it's really difficult to go through. But, like, the story of it is just so good. But, like...
Speaking of the Oscars, I'd like to speak about this year's Oscars. And first off, I'd like to say that the animated film category was... What's the word?
Rigged?
Snubbed.
Rigged. There we go. Disney
Riggery
won for Coco.
Wait, I thought Spider-Verse won.
That was last year.
Well, yeah. That's
okay,
what
Spider-Verse
I meant.
Won this year.
2018. I guess it was because it was like a 2017 film. Okay, but Coco won, and I love Coco. But also, Loving Vincent is the first fully painted film, and they had 65,000 panels, and 125 artists painted these panels, and I think that's amazing. And these people came from all around the world to create this story about Vincent van Gogh, which, I mean, a lot of people like his artworks, but they don't really know his story. So I liked how they portrayed that. But anyways, I thought that film was beautiful. So I was really upset whenever it didn't get really any recognition.
Did it get nominated at all? Do you know?
It did get nominated, but it was snubbed by Coco. Mm-hmm. I do love me some Coco, but I would also like to see moving forward that like Mexican-based movies that are based in tradition focus less on Dia de los Muertos and focus more on like other aspects of Mexican culture, but like that's just me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like when it comes to Mexican culture, Hollywood just paints it as it's either Dios de los Muertos or like La Llorona. There's no in between. That's the only we either respect our ancestors or are afraid of a ghost.
It's just about death. It's that's all Mexican culture is about, you know?
That's
anyways, continue, Kendall, because I know you have a cent or two about this one.
Both movies were really colorful, and that transitions into Kendall's bit here about color scheme in movies.
All right, so I'm going to talk about color scheme. So the purpose of color schemes is to draw focus to significant details, set the tones of movies, represent character traits, and show arcs and stories and so on and so forth. Some common color schemes are like pastels, so like pink, lilac, like beige for like romantic comedies, or in more recent trends we have blue, green, and gray to get like sci-fi and just really intense bright colors. And so talk more about that. I'm gonna mention three movies. I'm gonna start with Her, which is romantic comedy, what was it, like 2013, and features Juan Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson. And I was going to mention that almost every scene features the color red. And it's kind of like in these like soft like apple reds, you know, and like soft like pinks. And it's just a lot of like gentle, like muted sort of colors to kind of represent its story, which is about loneliness. And I think those colors make it more relatable, because even though, despite the fact that, you know, he's in love with his computer, it's still a love story, and, you know, feeling connection with someone. And just loneliness is, you know, we all feel lonely sometimes. So I think those colors really connect with that.
I mean, I have a twin, so I never get to be alone. Oh, it's kind of like, you know, she's always there. Someone's always there.
No, go ahead.
I just have a question. Yeah. Just why do they associate beige with romantic comedies? Like, I don't want to hate on the color beige. I was thinking, like, are they all, like, wearing khakis? Do they incorporate that in every scene or something?
I was, like, I don't know, just, like, soft colors. And looking at your website, and I said beige.
Beige just kind of seems like a boring color for a romantic comedy.
Kind of just, like, I guess, to, like, match with, like, the pastels, I guess, you know, to make it a whole scheme. Then, moving on, we have Shape of Water.
Oof.
The weirdest movie I think I've ever seen. It encompasses a lot of cool shades, like, you know, blues and greens to represent, you know, water. It's about a woman, just, you know, wrap it all up, a woman that falls in love with an amphibian man.
Amphibian man.
Yeah, it is, you know, cool colors are usually associated with, like, sadness and, you know, just, like, somber times. But I think because she feels, like, more secure in the water and with him, it kind of, like, elicits, like, happiness, which is in contrast to its usual purpose. And then, like, warmer colors like yellow and red, which are associated with more happier and, you know, kind of sunshiny times, are they like symbolize like bad, like the main antagonist, which I forgot his name, but he's played by Michael Shannon. Like, I think his whole house is yellow, and I thought that was weird. And I think it's like he is like highlighting like he's the bad guy, like, because he's the worst in that movie. He's such
a jerk. He's horrible. Great acting, just like
yeah, it was a very like somber film. It was also very quiet because neither of them talked.
Very odd.
Yeah, she's mute. Yeah, it's really cool though. I like it. Then we have The Shining, which I'm gonna be completely honest, still haven't seen. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. But it's okay. I looked through a couple of scenes, and I noticed that, again, coming back to the color red, is very, very prominent. I was reading about it, and it said that red is, like, a motif throughout the film. So it's literally everywhere, but it, like, shows up when there's, like, a supernatural occurrence, or, like, Jack's jacket. So, like, going back to character traits. And it's kind of like a warning sign for when there's danger. So, red rum, there it is. Yeah, so
I like how similar colors can be used for different kinds of movies. Like, red can be used to symbolize, like, romance and all of that, but also, like, violence. And it just kind of depends on the film.
Well, like, in contrast to, like, Shape of Water, if you think about, like, The Matrix, that has amazing
green.
Yeah, the green. Anytime they're in The Matrix, it's tinted green, and it's such an easy distinction. So it's like, okay, we're in The Matrix, and you have, like, the symbolism of, like, the red and the blue pill. You know, The Matrix, like, the Wachowskis really did a great job about, you know, it's such a revolutionary film, especially at, the turn of the millennium. Like the rest of the ones aren't good, but, like, the first one is, like, amazing.
You know where color plays, like, a really good role? This isn't necessarily a movie. It's a TV show on Hulu where colors play a good role.
Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah, Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
But that's because it's really significant to the plot line.
Yeah, so it plays a big role in it. Mm-hmm. And I also think it does, like, create a lot of visual separation. For example, whenever you're in the main character's place where she's staying, it's all, like, really dark. But there's, like, this one house where it's, like, really bright outside. And, like, I don't know. It's always really interesting to see how they do all their camera work, because it's really... it's really precise. Well,
and the characters themselves, like, have specific colors. Like, all the handmaids are red, all the wives are green and teals, you know, then you have, like, the Marthas and, like,
beige.
You know.
Beige.
Yeah. The...
I think it's gray for the Marthas.
Yeah. And, like, the ants are, like,
gray's
brown.
The Econo people.
Econo wives.
The Econo Wives.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, visually distinct films and visually risky films, they really help films because it just makes it stand out. It makes a memorable visual experience. So I think it really helps films.
I also like the color scheme in Call Me By Your Name. It's all pastels and such, which kind of, I think, hypes up, like, the romance of it and just, like, the aesthetics of the whole movie, like, the setting and the scenery. It adds a lot to that.
Our next topic I wanted to bring up was movies about art. Since this is an art history podcast, we have some movies about art. Some of my favorites are Big Eyes, if you guys have seen that one.
Love Big Eyes.
Velvet Buzzsaw on Netflix as well. I don't know if you guys have seen that one either.
I've heard of it.
That is,
it
looks weird. Jake Gyllenhaal in it.
It is very weird.
Big Eyes, though, is like, that was like a wide release movie, and so that one's like pretty well known. Mm-hmm. Also, once again, Amy Adams snubbed out of an Oscar. She's been nominated as many times as Leo, still hasn't won.
Right. Yeah, Big Eyes was actually directed by Tim Burton, too, so another connection there.
There you go. It definitely does have that, like, Tim Burton-esque feel, and I think it's just really playing off of the painter's, the artist's paintings, you know? I can't remember her name exactly. You know the artist that Amy Adams played? Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, but, like, definitely her paintings, like, with those huge eyes, you know, they say that's, like, the window of the soul, and it's, like, it has that whole kind of, like, eerie feel to it. It's really interesting to watch.
Yeah, the paintings do kind of have, like, a Tim Burton vibe, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Keane is who you're referencing.
Yes, lady. Correct.
Liz. Yeah, yeah. Another movie about art is Moulin Rouge. Y'all talk about it a lot. I still haven't seen it.
Moulin Rouge is so good, you know?
It's, like, entertaining and, like,
the way deep. That they, like, alter the songs to make it fit with the plot, because you can, like... Like, a movie that doesn't alter the songs, just, for example, Mamma Mia, which I am not a huge fan of, to Haley's dismay. But Moulin Rouge, it alters the songs and makes it fit with the plot, and there's, you know, just, it's so, like, emotional and passionate and sad. I love Moulin Rouge.
In my defense, I think part of the reason I love Mamma Mia is because it's filmed in, like, Greece, and also I love ABBA, okay. And also I love Meryl Streep.
I think in your defense, you're just, like, a theater kid, so, like, you get that.
Also, I saw it for the first time when I was, like, 8 or 9, because it came out a while ago, and when I was that age, I was so into it. So good.
Any other movie topics we want to talk about before we wrap it up?
My favorite movie, Emperor's New Groove. That's the only thing I want to say. I think that's a good movie. Actually, I did want to... Yeah, it is my favorite. Yeah, it is top spot. You can't take it. Like, you can make an amazing movie. I watched some really good movies. Like
nothing as good as Emperor's New Groove, though.
Like, it takes a place in my heart. But mainly, I wanted to talk about Hayao Miyazaki. Do you know him? He is with Studio Ghibli.
I think love Studio Ghibli.
His films, like, they're... Of, like, I guess it's technically, is it technically anime? I consider it, like,
it's like an anime-esque style.
I feel like that's the biggest kind of closest thing to, like, mainstream, I guess, anime, like, here in America. Because it won an Oscar for Spirited Away.
Spirited Away is such a good movie. I can't even, like, express to you how good the Studio Ghibli, I'm not really exactly sure how to say it, but the Studio Ghibli movies are just incredible. And then now you have, like, other artists that are, like, taking inspiration from that. Like, there's, like, this really popular movie called Your Name, which is so good. Like,
I know that movie.
Actually. Have you seen it?
Yeah, the one where the girl is, like, deaf and it's, like, love story. Oh, different one. Sorry.
With the red band, though? Like, the red hair tie?
Maybe.
No, maybe not. Okay, that's okay. Basically, like, these two teenagers, like, switch bodies.
Oh, never mind.
Never mind, yeah. No, it's really good.
Do you mean Freaky Friday with Jamie Lee Curtis
and Lindsay Lohan? Speaking of Freaky Friday, that movie's good. Like, that's what I'm saying.
Also, Parent Trap.
Ooh, Parent Trap. Mean Girls. That's a good Lindsay Lohan movie. That's such a classic.
Shout out Lindsay Lohan.
Shout out Lindsay Lohan. Good for you for getting back on your feet.
Yeah.
Well, I want to bring up Studio Ghibli mainly because of its... relevance for, like, it's one of the few from its genre to make it big in the U.S. And they also had, like, The Wind Rises, that also was nominated for an Oscar. It's kind of, I think, more of, like, because there's so many animated movies that when y'all were mentioning, like, Coco and some other things. I think Emperor's New Groove did actually get Oscar, like, nominated once.
You know what got Oscar nominated? Jimmy Neutron. The movie. Serious? I am serious. I'm pretty sure it won. It was, like, back in, like, 2001 when they first, like, started, you know, having Oscar captions for animated movies. Because that, you know, this is only, this is like a turn of the century kind of thing. That you didn't really have a lot of animated movies, especially in the mainstream, with 3D technology until, like, the 2000s. You know, like, Toy Story was kind of, like, the pioneer films and all those Pixar films. Not related, but kind of related. I want to talk about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Love that movie.
Which is honestly, like, one of the best, like, animated movies I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's so, so good.
It's so good.
Yeah, I knew it was going to win the Oscar, and it did, so. Yeah. Amazing art. Really good story.
Who is it even up against? I don't even remember the other movies that it was up against.
The big rival was Incredibles 2.
Also, the Emoji Movie was up there. I have no idea why.
Are you?
Oh. Yeah, yeah. No, it was one. It was nominated.
Emoji Movie was nominated.
Yeah, but anyways, back to Studio Ghibli. It was it was nominated 5 times. For, like, their movies were nominated 5 times for Oscars, and I think, like, you know, whenever you're up against a big competitor like Disney, like, that's really impressive. I mean, of course, they're huge and they've got, like, a lot of money to spend on movies, but, like, I don't know, just the American influence versus non-American, like, doing so well in America.
Definitely,
I think that's pretty cool.
Well, even, like, this year, like, I watched the animated shorts that were nominated for the Oscars, and they had some really incredible ones. I really liked, but the one that won was Bao, which was the Pixar one.
Yeah.
Bao was really cute, there's, like, they have a lot of interesting, like, short films, and I really, like, enjoyed watching them this year. You know, I, like, saw all the Oscar-nominated short films, and they are such incredibly, like, powerful stories packed into, like, this 15-minute screenplays, and it is insane to watch, especially if you do, like, a marathon of them, which I did. So you see, like, these 5, like harrowing movies, like, right in a row, and they just keep getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, you know, and you're like, oh my god, like, I need a break from this. But it's, they're so good, they're just so horrible.
Yeah, I'll have to see them. There has to be somewhere you can get them, like a streaming service or something.
Yeah,
I'll also look it up.
Highly recommend. Here's my not-so-fun fact for films. Only one woman in Oscar history has won the Best Director title, and that was Kathryn Bigelow with The Hurt Locker in 2008. I think there's been, like, maybe 5 other women that have been nominated, I think about, so.
But let's just put this down in history right now. The next one's gonna be me.
Speak it into existence.
So, our trivia question for next week is, how many content areas are there in the AP Art History Test? Tune in next time to find out.
Tassin's tip for today is to study.
There you go.
Something he should have done. Never know. Let's redact that. Let's redact that.
Check out our blog.
Yes.
www.artistweknowitpodcast.wordpress.com.
Hey, good job. Without a scratch.
Memory. From memory.
Thank you for listening to our podcast.
This was an especially long one. Thanks for, like, sitting through it.
Thanks for liking, commenting, and subscribing.
Because we just assume that you will.
Yes, exactly.
So we're making you in advance.
I think you can follow.
Subscribe anyways, all right?
Subscribe anyways. Hit that smash that like button.
Hit that smash
and,
the like.
Comment below, what's your favorite movie and or what's the worst movie you've seen?